manuscripts, please. I guess the whole thing, in one sense, could be called a syllabus, but I call the overview sheet at the front a syllabus, and I'm not sure that's technically correct. Maybe it's more like a prospectus. But anyway, take a look at whatever it is. And see that we have there three things about the course. You have the course outline. There's your convenient summary of where we're going and how far we've gotten. I see that we have three parts to the course. And nothing particularly authoritative about this, except that it seemed a good way to divide the consideration of the subject. Part one of the course deals with historical introductions. There I endeavor to give you something of a history of eschatology in the church. Part two is structural considerations, in which I try to, as a result of those things, give you an overview of the structure of redemptive history and the major structure of especially eschatological history and the end of the age. And then part three deals with special questions and basically moves chronologically from the gospel age and questions concerning it to, and here some of you may have had previous editions of the notes, you'll see that there's been some change. This is one of the things I hope is an improvement in the notes this time. Then we come to the imminent return of Christ and deal with some considerations with regard to that. And then section 3 is the bodily resurrection, and section 4 is the eternal state, in which we deal with the two issues, burning issues, of the doctrine of eternal punishment and then the doctrine of the redeemed earth. You already have been given the reading of the course. I trust that many of you have been able to get Hokumah's The Bible in the Future, or if you'd already read that, Bavinck's The Last Thing. Both of them are excellent texts on this subject. I hope that you'll have an opportunity too sometime to read Voss's Redemptive History and Biblical Interpretation, and especially his Pauline Eschatology, which is really a significant work of eschatology in the history of the church. Now let me say something about course grading. And you see what's written there. Grading will be based on daily short answer quizzes, which will be 40% of the grade on the previous day's material, a final exam 50%, and the completion of the required reading 10%. The completion of Bavinck will bring an extra credit of 5% on the course grade. All the questions on the final exam will be taken from the daily quizzes and are due 2 weeks after the date of the final lecture. Now, I don't lightly ask you to do quizzes. I don't do that lightly. I know you're a busy man and you come here with weary minds, but I simply do it primarily because I believe that these kind of short answer quizzes, which will focus on big issues and not details, are a good way to have a cumulative effect of your getting the material in your minds, and they kind of create a little bit of pressure to review the material, and that's something I want to create, frankly, so that you'll come and just put a little pressure on yourself to know the big picture of what we've said in the previous day's lecture, so that these things can build cumulatively, and then I would hope that you would as well do the final exam. I know you are busy men, and so I don't say that lightly, and I can only ask it of you, but if you do that, I'll certainly grade your exam and send you your final grade and also a letter of completion for whatever that's worth. All right? But the method focuses on attention to the major issues, and that allows the quizzes to kind of clarify what the real highlights are, what the real cruxes are of the lectures. And that's what the quizzes will be focused on. So at the beginning of each day, we'll take 10 or 15 minutes. I'll give you 8 questions and let you answer them. And then we'll go over those questions, and I'll have you hand in your quizzes so I can see how you're doing how bad a job I'm doing, I guess, is the other issue, all right? All right. Well, that having been said about the syllabus, any questions about that? Anything I didn't really make clear in terms of what we'll be doing? Beginning the first lecture of each day, beginning tomorrow, we'll have an 8-question quiz on the previous day's lecture. I'll give you a hypothetical quiz, too, on the last day that would would give you the questions that would hypothetically be asked about the last day, because we won't get a chance to quiz about that, and then you'll know all the questions that could occur on the final exam, if you wish to do that, and I hope you do. All right? Any questions? Okay. Turn to page 1 of the notes. Which is historical introduction. Now, my experience in teaching this particular part of the lectures tells me that I should probably subtitle part one of the course, A Historical Introduction, Eschatology Made Difficult by Men. And then I hope that I have, in fact, I've actually done this. I've taught, especially the first section of part two of the course on the two ages, I've actually preached on that and had the audacity to entitle it Eschatology Made Simple. So what we're going to get today is, first of all, Eschatology Made Difficult by Men, and then I hope what you will agree with me is Eschatology Made Simple by God in His Word. So I forewarn you that as we study the history of the church on this subject, there are going to be some things that may tangle your brains up, but I think overall it will be a good exercise to acquaint you with the basic options and alternatives that the history of the church confronts us with in terms of eschatological interpretation. All right? So, by way of general introduction, systematic theology is properly the fruit of two other theological disciplines, exegetical theology and historical theology. Normally we draw it like this. At least I do. That's wrong. I want the straight line here and the dotted line here. Historical theology and exegetical theology combine in the study of systematic theology to, in terms of any topic of the scriptures, give us a thorough and seasoned study of that topic. Now, exegetical theology, in my view, so to speak, provides the raw materials and blueprint for any study in systematic theology, while historical theology provides the expert counsel with which to build the house. Now, the point is, of course, that eschatology is one of the topics or loci of systematic theology. You know, many of you, that the basic topics covered under standard systematic theology begin with perhaps apologetics, proceed to the doctrine of the Word, doctrine of God, man, salvation, Christ, God, man, Christ, salvation, and then ordinarily church, and then the last subject dealt with in systematic theology is last things. And so, as a part of systematic theology, eschatology should also be properly the fruit of the interaction of exegetical and historical theology. And of course, I'm not saying that historical theology has any per se authority or divine authority for systematic theology, but I am saying that it does provide us the expert counsel of the ages, whereas to say exegetical theology provides us with the actual blueprint and authoritative matter for systematic theology, and therefore for one of the loci of systematic theology, eschatology. Now, the purpose then of the first part of these lectures is to examine briefly the expert advice of historical theology with regard to the subject at hand. That is to say, it's our goal in this overview to examine the basic views and perspectives, opinions, options, and alternatives on the subject of eschatology, which professing Christians and Orthodox theologians throughout the history of the church have set before us in their teaching ministries. Now, an overview like this can never be uninteresting or distasteful to us if we remember two things. First, we must remember that the promises of Christ to be with and build His church throughout this age and between the two advents are relevant and important to us. Jesus Christ promised to build His church. He promised to be with His church as they went about the earth fulfilling the Great Commission throughout the age. That means that we can expect, among other important things, to find in the history of the church a maturing understanding of the doctrinal content of the deposit of truth once delivered to all the saints. We can expect that because Christ is building His church and continuing to be with His church, that the church will have a maturing ability to articulate what the Scriptures actually teach. The Scriptures don't change, of course, but the church's ability to articulate, understand, and teach the Scriptures, that does change. And If you study church history, it's quite obvious that it does. Second, we must remember that it is always a good thing in the study of any subject to have set before us all the different opinions and options available to us as we study the Word of God. Of course, some people react into a kind of skepticism when they begin to realize all the various doctrinal opinions which professing Christians have held. But that's both wrong and unnecessary. Skepticism is always the wrong response to that scriptural revelation which the Reformation has taught us is not only authoritative, but also sufficient and clear. 2 Timothy 3:15 through 17 teaches that the Word of God, the God-breathed Scriptures, is sufficient to equip the man of God for every good work, and therefore sufficient to equip us to teach what the Bible teaches about last things. But such skepticism in reaction to church history is also unnecessary. Orthodox Christianity throughout the ages is unified enough with regard to the great fundamentals of the doctrine of last things, and the fact that other Christians have believed and held error because of the remaining sin and darkness of their minds, not because there was something wrong with the Bible, because of their remaining sin, that fact does not negate the ability of the Spirit of God to lead the Church of Christ into a better understanding of scriptural truth. In fact, the very missteps of past generations may be overruled to help us see the proper way more clearly today. And since Christ continues to build His church today, we may have hope that we may see things more clearly than past generations did. Now, an overview of the thinking of Christians throughout the ages on the doctrine of last things is therefore of great practical importance to any study of eschatology. It's sad, therefore, that such studies appear to be rather rare. I note some in a footnote. It's certainly true that books on prophecy and the last things rarely worry much about the expert counsel of the ages, and I think that's one of their great defects. This part of these lectures is simply a humble but necessary attempt at a beginning in providing an adequate overview of the history of the doctrine of last things. The major periods of intense doctrinal discussion about the subject of eschatology have been the early church and the modern church. Therefore, this treatment of the history of eschatology will treat first eschatology in the early and medieval church periods, and then eschatology in the Reformation and modern periods of the church. So we'll cover the whole history of the church in two lectures under two basic sections of part one. All right? So what I've been doing here is basically justifying to you and defending to you of the importance of studying church history, even though we don't believe with Roman Catholicism that it has any particular authority in terms of having divine authority. It's still a very important thing for us not to be so wise in our own eyes to think that we can learn nothing from those teaching ministries of the gifts that the Spirit of Christ has given to the church for the last 20 centuries. The Spirit of Christ and Christ Himself has been giving gifts to the church for 20 centuries, and if we think that we can learn nothing from those gifts, we are arrogant men indeed. All right? Hence, the importance of studying church history. But now, section one of the course, then, is eschatology in the early and medieval church. And Roman numeral one is the apostolic fathers and early premillennialism. And something, first of all, by way of introduction. The phrase apostolic fathers is the common designation for the authors of early Christian writings who were the younger contemporaries of the apostles themselves. Now, the normal reaction of a Christian who learns that such men existed and there are writings available today from them, and who with high expectations sits down to read the writings of such men, is, to say the least, disappointment. Though their writings are marked by a sincerity with regard to adhering faithfully to the teaching of the apostles, they are also marked by a superficiality with regard to understanding the teaching of the apostles. And for this reason, they are marked by a vulnerability to unconscious and yet serious deviations from the apostles' teaching. What I'm saying is, they wanted to follow the apostles. In heart, they were committed to apostolic Christianity, but their understanding was so defective that unconsciously, but yet still very seriously, they could depart from their teaching. There is, in fact, to be discovered, a pervasive moralism, what some people might call legalism, and an incipient Catholicism visible in their writings. You can already discern in the writings of these men, to put it bluntly, that there is a very legalistic tinge to the way they interpreted Christianity, and also you can see the seeds, not the full-blown thing, but the seeds from which later Roman Catholicism developed already. This being the case, of course, the question is automatically raised, do the apostolic fathers have any doctrinal significance at all for us? If the apostolic fathers can in no sense be authoritative guides, does it matter in the least what they believed on any issue? Well, William Cunningham's example here is noteworthy. He spends much time and effort showing the unauthoritative character of the apostolic fathers. He is a son of the Reformation, uninfluenced by any latent Roman Catholic tendency. He was a Scottish Presbyterian. But even Cunningham ascribes a certain weight to the teaching of the apostolic fathers. And here's what he says. Whatever weight may be ascribed to the opinions of the fathers, and on whatever grounds the weight that is ascribed to them may be made to rest, no one disputes the propriety and the importance of ascertaining as far as we can what their views really were. And most theologians in modern times, whatever opinions they may entertain upon the general question of the deference to be paid to the fathers, have shown some desire to exhibit in their own behalf the testimony of the early church. And so you have the phenomena of some Presbyterian who doesn't believe that they're authoritative at all, still wanting to go through them and find proof that they believe what he believes. Well, that's natural, though. That's not so contradictory as it seems. Whenever it could, with any plausibility, be adduced. And this has given rise to a great deal of learned, voluminous, and often intricate and wearisome discussion. Both in these more ancient, more modern times, men have acted upon a notion, more or less distinctly conceived, and more or less earnestly maintained, that the fact of a doctrine or system of doctrines having been held by the early church afforded some presumption that it had been taught by the apostles. As a general position, this may perhaps be admitted to be true, but it needs to be very cautiously applied and to be restricted within very narrow limits. So, this is who we're talking about and why we're talking about the apostolic fathers. Now, before coming to the question about the eschatology of the apostolic fathers, which is most debated, something must be said about their position as to certain basic doctrines of Christian eschatology. The basic doctrines of the bodily resurrection and eternal punishment, and of course I could include here the bodily return of Christ, are clearly upheld against all who would dispute them. Says Reinhold Seeberg, there is a vivid sense of the vanity and the perishable nature of this world, and of the glory of the eternal world, as well as the terrible character of the torments of hell. The end of all things is thought to be very near. The chief thing remained the final judgment of the world, and the certainty that the holy shall go to heaven to God, and the unholy to hell. This was involved in the idea of reward for earthly conduct. In the martyrdom of Polycarp, Seeberg's comments are confirmed. This is one of the writings normally classed as among the apostolic fathers. In this writing, we hear sentiments about eternal punishment in hell typical of the apostolic fathers. And again he said to him, I shall have you consumed with fire. This is the persecutor speaking to Polycarp. If you despise the wild beast, unless you change your mind. But Polycarp said, the fire you threaten burns but an hour and is quenched after a while. For you do not know the fire of the coming judgment and everlasting punishment that is laid up for the impious. So why do you believe? Why do you delay? Come, do what you will. The bodily resurrection receives special emphasis as well over against the Gnostic denial of the importance of the flesh. Of course, the Gnostics felt that the only thing that was important was the spirit and the flesh was unimportant, and whatever you did with it really didn't matter. Well, the early church reacted against that kind of Gnosticism and its docetic views, and this comes to the fore in the apostolic father's writing called Second Clement. Moreover, we read, let none of you say that this flesh will not be judged or rise again, which is what the Gnostics were saying. Consider this, in what state were you saved? In what state did you regain your sight? If it was not while you were in this flesh, Therefore, we should guard the flesh as God's temple. For just as you were called in the flesh, reference to their conversion, you will come in the flesh, reference to their resurrection. If Christ the Lord who saved us was made flesh, though he was at first spirit, and called us in this way, in the same way, we too in this very flesh will receive our reward. So I'm just wanting to say, by way of background, that in terms of the basic doctrines of Orthodox Christianity, eternal punishment, bodily resurrection, second coming of Christ, the apostolic fathers were in agreement about those things. But now the great question in the matter of eschatology with regard to the apostolic fathers concerns premillennialism. Dr. Charles Feinberg in Premillennialism or Amillennialism has asserted the entire early church of the first three centuries was premillennial almost to a man. Now, this is an extraordinary statement. It is the more extraordinary in light of the fact that in the following discussion it will be shown that among the eight different Christian writers usually classed as apostolic fathers, there is good evidence for premillennialism in only one, the apostolic father known as Papias. Reputable historians sometimes do assert that other apostolic fathers held premillennialism. Seberg, for instance, affirms that Papias and Barnabas were Kilius, and it is indeed, the word Kilius, of course, is a synonym here for premillennialist, it is indeed only the fragments of Papias and the so-called Epistle of Barnabas which require examination with regard to the question of premillennialism in the apostolic fathers. Sometimes you read rare comments about other men being premillennialists, but the only two writers in which there's any reason even to discuss whether they're premillennialists are Papias and the so-called Barnabas. All right? By the way, the term Kilius is derived from the Greek kilios, millennium is the parallel for the word millennium, in which is Latin in its derivation. Okay. So Kilias and premillennialist in most contexts are synonyms, although not at all, and I'll say something about that later. Okay. All right, let's proceed then. Well, we come then to the nature of the question. It's important here not to allow the obscuring of the question being discussed. The question here is not whether the apostolic fathers taught the doctrine in some sense of the imminent return of Christ, or whether they taught the doctrine even of a personal antichrist. Now, both of those doctrines are often associated today with premillennialism, but neither of them form the actual content or essence of premillennialism. Both the Didache, chapter 16, and the Epistle of Barnabas, chapters 4 and 15, teach the coming of a personal antichrist. Both these points have, of course, historically been associated with premillennialism. It is probably the comparatively widespread presence of these views in the apostolic fathers which is responsible for the reputation they have of being premillennial. In some periods of church history, the only viable options have appeared to be postmillennialism or premillennialism. And viewed from within such an assumed framework or tension between only those two options, the apostolic fathers and the anti-Nicene church, that is to say the church before the year 325, which is the approximate date of the Nicene Council, the anti-Nicene church as a whole certainly would appear premillennial. The doctrines, however, of an imminent return of Christ and the personal antichrist are adopted by many who are not premillennial. They are held today, for instance, by many who would call themselves amillennial. The sine qua non, or essence, of premillennialism is neither the doctrine of the imminence of Christ's return nor the doctrine of a personal antichrist. It is rather the doctrine of a millennial reign after Christ's return and before the eternal state. Now, I assume that most of you men know this, and I don't need to say this, but the structure of premillennialism is, of course, very plain in its general contours. You have the
resurrection of Christ here, the return of Christ here, the gospel age between them, and between the return of Christ and the coming of the eternal state, you have the 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth. This is premillennialism,
and so it's often been associated with the idea that a personal antichrist comes here at the end of the age,
and though it's often been associated with the idea of the imminent return of Christ, although that's a disputed phrase, those two things are simply side issues and not of the essence
of premillennialism. This is the essence of premillennialism, that there will be a 1,000-year reign of Christ after his return on earth and before the eternal state. That is premillennialism. Now, having seen the nature of the question, we've got to come to an examination of the evidence. As noted above, only in the writings of two of the apostolic fathers is there possible evidence of premillennialism. Those two apostolic fathers are Papias and the so-called Barnabas. We will therefore examine the relevant statements in the fragments of Papias and also what is called the Epistle of Barnabas. First of all, the fragments of Papias. Papias claimed, or was thought to be, a hearer of John the Apostle and a friend of the martyr Polycarp, who was also a disciple of John, it is said. Now, this Papias is said to have written five books in which he recorded statements of John and other early disciples, of course, statements that aren't in our Bible, our New Testament. Here is the relevant statement of Papias as recorded in the church history of Eusebius, and you can see Eusebius interspersing his comments throughout it. Why, you ask, am I not quoting from Papias himself in his five books? Because they don't exist anymore. The only record of Papias we have is in the church history written by Eusebius in the early years of the 4th century. And here we read, as the elders who saw John the Apostle, he's quoting Papias now supposedly, as the elders who saw John the disciple of the Lord remembered that they had heard from him how the Lord taught in regard to those times and said, the days will come in which vines shall grow, having each 10,000 branches, and in each branch 10,000 twigs, and in each true twig 10,000 shoots, and in every one of the shoots 10,000 clusters, and on every one of the clusters 10,000 grapes, and every grape when pressed will give 25 metretas of wine. And when any of the saints shall lay hold of a cluster, another shall cry out, I am a better cluster, take me, bless the Lord through me. In like manner he said that a grain of wheat would produce 10,000 ears, and that every ear would have 10,000 grains, and every grain would yield 10 pounds of clear, pure, fine flour, and that apples and seeds and grass would produce in similar proportions, and that all animals feeding then only on the productions of the earth, not on each other's implication, would become peaceable and harmonious and be in perfect subjection to man. And here Eusebius' comments. Testimony is borne to these things in writing by Papias, an ancient man, who was a hearer of John and a friend of Polycarp, in the fourth of his books, for five books were composed by him. And he added, saying, now these things are credible to believers. And Judas the traitor, says he, not believing and asking, how shall such growth be accomplished by the Lord? The Lord said that they shall see who shall come to them. These then are the times mentioned by the prophet Isaiah, and the wolf shall lie down with the lamb. And then the quotation from Papias continues. As the presbyters say, then those who are deemed worthy of an abode in heaven shall go there. Others shall enjoy the delights of paradise. So there's a distinction assumed here between paradise and heaven. And others shall possess the splendor of the city. For everywhere the Savior will be seen, according as they shall be worthy who see him. So there's a distinction here between heaven, paradise, and the city of God, as three progressively less degrees of glory. For everywhere the Savior will be seen, according as they shall be worthy who see him. But that there is this distinction between the habitation of those who produce 100-fold, who apparently go to heaven, and that of those who produce 60-fold, who go to paradise, and that of those who produce 30-fold, who go to the city of God. For the first will be taken up to the heavens, see? The second class will dwell in paradise, and the last will inhabit the city, and then on this account the Lord said, in my Father's house are many mansions. For all things belong to God and supplies all with a suitable dwelling place, even as his word says, that a share is given to all by the Father according as each one is or shall be worthy. And this is the couch in which they shall recline who feast, being invited to the wedding. The presbyters and the disciples of the apostles say that this is the gradation and arrangement of those who are saved, and that they advance through steps of this nature. And now this is identified with the Trinity. Notice what he says. And that, moreover, they ascend through the Spirit to the Son, and through the Son to the Father. So if you've gotten all the way to the Father, you're in heaven. If you're just to the Son, you're in paradise. If you're just in the Spirit, you're in the city of God. I guess we could apply this against charismatics, but I won't bother. At any rate, that in due time the Son will yield up his work to the Father, even as it is said by the apostles, for he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy shall be destroyed is death. Well, here he's quoting 1 Corinthians. For in the times of the kingdom, the just man who is on earth shall forget to die. But when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted, which did put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also be himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all. The same person, now here we have Eusebius again, moreover has set down other things as coming to him from unwritten tradition. Amongst these, some strange parables and instructions of the Savior, and some other things of a more fabulous nature. Amongst these, he says that there will be a millennium after the resurrection from the dead, when the personal reign of Christ will be established on this earth. Well, in his comments, then, on these fragments of Papias' writings, Eusebius asserts that Papias was a premillennialist. Now, the evidence of the fragments themselves, while it's not explicit, are probable evidence, I think, that he indeed was, and that Eusebius' interpretation is indeed correct. Well, that's Papias. And so we conclude by admitting that Papias does seem to have been a premillennialist. But we must come then to what is known as the Epistle of Barnabas and chapter 15 of that writing. The Epistle of Barnabas was not written by the biblical Barnabas. It doesn't claim to be, in fact, but it's traditionally known as the Epistle of Barnabas, and probably dates from approximately the year 131. Even so, it is a valuable early Christian writing. And chapter 15 of the so-called Epistle of Barnabas is a very valuable part of that writing and very important from several angles in the history of doctrine, including the subject of eschatology. The problem is, however, that this chapter is also a very complex and convoluted statement of whatever it is that this Barnabas believes. And I'll quote it so you can see for yourself. Here it is. Further, also, it is written concerning the Sabbath and the Decalogue, which the Lord spoke face to face to Moses on Mount Sinai, and sanctify ye the Sabbath of the Lord with clean hands and a pure heart. And he says in another place, if my sons keep the Sabbath, then I will cause my mercy to rest upon them. The Sabbath is mentioned at the beginning of the creation thus, and God made in 6 days the works of his hands, and made an end on the seventh day, and rested on it, and sanctified it. Attend, my children, to the meaning of this expression. He finished in 6 days. This implies that the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years, for a day will be as 1,000 years. Therefore, my children, in 6 days, that is in 6,000 years, all things will be finished. And he rested on the seventh day. This meaneth, when his Son, coming again, shall destroy the time of the wicked man, and judge the ungodly, and change the sun and the moon and the stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day. Moreover, he says, thou shalt sanctify it with pure hands and a pure heart. If therefore anyone can now sanctify the day which God hath sanctified, except he is pure in heart in all things, we are deceived. Behold, therefore, certainly then one properly resting sanctifies it, when we ourselves, having received the promise, wickedness no longer existing, and all things having been made new by the Lord, shall be able to work righteousness, then we shall be able to sanctify it, having been first sanctified ourselves. Further, he says to them, your new moons and your Sabbaths I cannot endure. Ye perceive how he speaks. Your present Sabbaths are not acceptable to me, but that is which I have made, namely this, when, giving rest to all things, I shall make a beginning of the eighth day, that is a beginning of another world. Wherefore also we keep the eighth day with joyfulness, a reference to early Christian Sabbath keeping, the day also on which Jesus rose again from the dead. And when he had manifested himself, he ascended into the heaven. Now, that's what he says. The question is, of course, what does he mean? Well, this is a highly complex passage. I don't need to argue that to you now, do I? Superficially read, it does have a premillennial ring. It must be noted, however, that Barnabas makes no explicit reference to a thousand-year period on the seventh day. He speaks only of the destruction of the Antichrist, the judgment of the ungodly, and the rest of the Messiah. W.J. Greer aptly comments, Barnabas' scheme of history was patterned on the week of creation in Genesis 1. And that's an idea that's occurred to people since Barnabas, hasn't it? The expression, he finished in 6 days, means, he says, that the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years. The expression, he rested on the seventh day, contains the prophetic meaning that when Christ, coming again, shall destroy the time of the wicked man and judge the ungodly and change the sun and the moon and the stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day. Premillenarians take this seventh day of the millennium. Well, what premillenarian is willing to admit that the millennium is ushered in by the judgment of the ungodly, as Barnabas states? According to the Epistle of Barnabas, the seventh day will not come till wickedness is no longer existing, and all things have been made new. The eighth day is the beginning of another world, but all distinction seems to be done away between the seventh and eighth day when Barnabas says that the Lord, in giving rest to all things, which happens on the seventh day, makes the beginning of the eighth day that is the beginning of another world. So in other words, what Greer is saying is that though there's a premillennial ring to this, once you look at it more closely, it's not so clear that it's premillennial or that Barnabas is that consistent as to say that the seventh day is another thousand-year period. You have the 6 days of history. Then you have the return of Christ. Then you have the seventh day. But the seventh day comes when wickedness is no longer existing and after the judgment of the ungodly, and then it seems almost to be identified with the eighth day. And there doesn't seem to be a clear distinction in Barnabas' mind between the seventh day and the eighth day. And so though this, you know, is subject to a possible premillennial interpretation, there are lots of questions about this that aren't so clear. And not so clear even to some premillennialists themselves. Look at the next paragraph from Greer. It is clear at any rate, says Greer, that Barnabas shuts out the possibility of an earthly millennium in which unregenerate men will be under the reign of Christ, because wickedness is no longer existing. It is perfectly clear, too, that he holds, as all others of his time, that Christians and not Jews are the heirs of the covenant. It is interesting to note that D.H. Cromega, a premillenarian, says, the presumption is that Barnabas is what we nowadays call an amillennialist. Greer's exposition of this difficult passage certainly makes an amillennial interpretation of it possible, if not necessary. If this plausible and amillennial interpretation of Barnabas is adopted or even entertained as possible, then the only clear evidence for premillennialism in the apostolic fathers is Papias. And what about Papias? Well, Papias claims apostolic sources for his statement. And yet, the fantastic character of what he records right along with that, as coming from the apostolic circle, raises serious questions about his credibility. I mean, if you can read your New Testaments and associate and distinguish heaven, paradise, and the city of God, and then put the hundredfold in one place, 60 in another, and 30 in another, if you can find that in your New Testament, you're a better man than I am. Thus, we must admit that Papias was very probably a premillennialist, but also entertained grave reservations as to the supposed source of the statements recorded by Papias. I mean, the things he says, the Lord said, and Judas' question, again, you can read that and credit it as having any kind of real credibility as coming from the Lord. Again, I have to say I just can't credit it. So, there's real questions about the credibility of this supposed source, whether it's John or the Lord himself. For whatever questions we may have, having all said all this, about the presence of premillennialism in the apostolic fathers, it is certainly and widely present in the next period of the early church, the second through the fourth centuries. And so I want to come to that. I will give an opportunity for questions at the end of this hour, but I think it's better to go right straight through the early church. And if you have questions, note them in the margin. We'll come back and give you an opportunity to ask them. All right? So Roman numeral 2 is the growth of early premillennialism. and something by way of introduction. Premillennialism enjoyed great popularity during the 2nd through the 4th centuries of the Christian era. This becomes evident, first of all, in the writings of the man known as Justin, a martyr. Martyr wasn't his last name. He became known as the martyr because he was martyred. So, Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr, since his writings date from approximately the year 160, may be mentioned first here. He makes mention of his premillennialism in his dialogue with Trypho the Jew, chapters 76 through 81. It is very clear that Justin is a premillennialist. He says in chapter 80, "But I and others who are right-minded Christians on all points are assured that there will be a resurrection of the dead and 1,000 years in Jerusalem, which will then be built, adorned, and enlarged, as the prophets Ezekiel and Isaiah and others declare." Other considerations, however, blunt the edge of Justin's witness for premillennialism in the early church. First, Justin makes clear that not all Christians agree with him about premillennialism. You notice, "I and others who are right-minded Christians on all points." This is implied in the above statement, but it's also made explicit earlier in the same chapter. Trypho the Jew is cross-examining Justin about his belief that Jerusalem will be rebuilt as the center of a joyful fellowship of the Christ and his people during the millennium. "Is he really serious," asked Trypho, "in affirming a doctrine which is held by the Jews?" Justin replied, "I am not so miserable a fellow, Trypho, as to say one thing and think another. I admitted to you formally that I and many others are of this opinion and believe that such will take place, as you assuredly are aware. But on the other hand, I signify to you that many," now notice the statement, "who belong to the pure and pious faith and are true Christians think otherwise." So there is a disagreement between premillennialists and other Christians even in the 2nd century. Second, Justin's premillennialism is not only inconsistent with other statements he makes, it is also of a different kind than that commonly taught today. One of the great thrusts of Justin's dialogue with Trypho the Jew is the doctrine that Christians are the true Jews. And you can see that stated again and again in chapters 11, 120, 123, 125, and 135 of his dialogue with Trypho the Jew. Greer ably brings out these inconsistencies in Justin's premillennialism. When Justin Martyr is speaking of the kingdom for which Christians look, he denies that it is a human kingdom. You suppose we speak of a human kingdom, whereas we speak of that which is with God. Justin speaks of a general judgment at Christ's second coming, when death shall forever quit those who believe on him and be no more, when some are sent to be punished unceasingly into judgment and condemnation of fire, but others shall exist in freedom from suffering, from corruption, and from grief, and in immortality. From these statements, one would suppose that there was no room for an earthly millennium in his teaching. Yet, inconsistently, he says elsewhere that there will be a resurrection of the dead and 1,000 years in Jerusalem, which will then be built, adorned, and enlarged. And that thereafter the general, and in short, the eternal resurrection and judgment of all men would likewise take place. Justin's millennium would have no special place at all for the Jew, for he tells us over and over that Christians are the true Israelite race. He tells us that he and others who are right-minded Christian on all points hold to this notion of a millennium, but he admits that many who belong to the pure and pious faith and are true Christians think otherwise. Papias and Justin, then, are the only two of all the writers in the first 60 years of the 2nd century who may with any certainty be called premillenarians, and Justin is decidedly inconsistent. Others definitely, by their statements, exclude premillenarianism. The first two volumes of the Fathers in the Ante-Nicene Library contain 950 pages, but the indices give only two references under the word millennium. These two are to the statements of Papias and Justin. Well, we come on to Irenaeus, who lived and ministered in the years 170 or 80. Irenaeus was among the growing premillennial movement after the period of the Apostolic Fathers. Irenaeus, on the strength of tradition from St. John and his disciples, taught that after the destruction of the Roman Empire and the brief raging of the Antichrist, lasting 3.5 years or 1,260 days, Christ will visibly appear, will bind Satan, will reign at the rebuilt city of Jerusalem with a little band of faithful confessors and the host of risen martyrs over the nations of the earth, and will celebrate the millennial Sabbath of preparation for the eternal glory of heaven. Then after a temporary liberation of Satan follows the final victory, the general resurrection, the judgment of the world, and the consummation of the new heavens and the new earth. See Tertullian and the Montanist. Tertullian was a respected leader of the church in North Africa in the 3rd century as Bishop of Carthage. But his zeal caused him to admire from a distance the Montanists concentrated in the eastern part of the church. Shorthand for what a Montanist is, he was a 2nd century charismatic. That's what a Montanist was. In many different respects, there's quite amazing parallels. Sometimes Tertullian has even been called a Montanist, but if this is true at all, it is true only in a highly qualified sense. Tertullian did, however, agree with the Montanist in being a premillennialist. Says Shaw, Tertullian was an enthusiastic Kiliast, and pointed not only to the apocalypse, but also to the predictions of the Montanist prophets. But the Montanist substituted Papusa in Phrygia for Jerusalem as the center of Christ's reign, and ran into fanatical excesses which brought Kiliasm into discredit and resulted in its condemnation by several synods in Asia Minor. One authority gives this account of Montanist premillennialism. Not long after the beginning of the prophesying, Montanus crossed the Phrygian border and established himself with his followers in the city of Papusa. Papusa was the neighboring village of Timion, he named Jerusalem. To this settlement, which was thenceforward the center and holy city of Eastern Montanism, he endeavored to gather adherents from all quarters. These facts, coupled with the lavish promises made by the prophets to their adherents, and certain predictions of Maximilla, apart from a more explicit oracle attributed to another prophetess, would lead us to the conclusion that the new prophecy taught men to expect in the near future, at Papusa, the final parousia of the Lord. The primitive Montanist, in fact, held the doctrine of Kiliasm, but Kiliasm of a new kind. It was this hope of the parousia at their Jerusalem that gained for them the name of Papusians. It is not necessary to pursue the history of Eastern Montanism in detail. For some years after the death of Maximilla, a woman prophet, the last of the original trio in 179 to 180, there were no prophets, and the church and the world enjoyed peace, facts which, as anti-Montanistic writers pointed out, disproved the claims of the first prophet. D. Other premillennialists. Chop provides this concluding summary of other premillennialists in this period of church history. After Tertullian and independently of Montanism, Kiliasm was taught by Commodian towards the close of the 3rd century, Lactantius and Victorinus of Patal at the beginning of the 4th. Its last distinguished advocates in the East were Methodius, who died a martyr in 311, the opponent of Origen, and Apollinaris of Laodicea in Syria. Conclusion. The doctrinal significance of early premillennialism. Premillennialists, as the example of Charles Feinberg shows, often bring forward this early premillennialism as a matter of weighty doctrinal significance in favor of premillennialism. As we have seen, the prevalence of premillennialism may be easily overstated. Nevertheless, even when the evidence is properly weighed, this early premillennialism may still seem to create a doctrinal presumption in favor of premillennialism to some minds. It may still appear difficult for the opponents of premillennialism to explain the prominence of premillennialism in the early church. It may be asked, does not this evidence suggest that premillennialism originated within apostolic Christianity? To this question, it may be replied that it is not necessary to assume from the evidence presented that premillennialism originated within apostolic Christianity. For one thing, we've seen that Christians differed about it. As the quotations from Justin have already suggested, additionally, a Christian premillennialist did recognize, a remarkable similarity between his own views and those of the Jews. This tends to confirm the view that premillennialism originated within ancient Judaism. Masselink, in his polemic work against premillennialism, asked the question, what is the origin of this strange doctrine, you ask? The careful study of church history will furnish us with the conclusive answer. Premillennialism is a descent of ancient Judaism. There is a striking resemblance between the offspring and the parent. The old Jewish conception of an external messianic kingdom have found their perfect embodiment in the chiliastic theory of the millennium. Premillennialism is a relic of Judaism. Gerhardus Voss, in his Pauline eschatology, offers abundant evidence that within pre-Christian Judaism, there had grown up an eschatological system which related the idea of the messianic kingdom to the eternal state by way of making them consecutive phases in God's plan for history.
So in other words, among the intertestamental Jews, there was the idea that in the future, when Messiah came, there would be two phases to the kingdom. There would be the messianic kingdom, and then there would be the eternal state. All right? Now, the messianic kingdom was, you know, calculated to last certain different lengths of time. As we're going to see, one calculation was 400 years. There are other places, I am told, that the calculation was 1,000 years. We go on.
In 4th Ezra, for instance, the Christians coming out of a Judaistic background imported this view. I'm sorry, in 4th Ezra, for instance, the Messianic kingdom lasts 400 years at the end of history. Seems likely that early Christians coming out of a Judaistic background simply imported this view into their new faith. Rather than spiritualizing the Messianic kingdom, or in some way seeing the Messianic kingdom as already present in the church, they retained the entire Jewish eschatology and placed it at the end of history. Now, so in other words, what they did was simply take their understanding of last things from eschatology and place it all after the return of Christ. Instead of seeing the Messianic kingdom as somehow identified with the gospel age, they simply shoved it all off into the future. They didn't spiritualize it. They took it literally. They just put it out into the future and made consecutive phases, the Messianic kingdom and then the eternal state. Now, this ancestry of premillennialism is, of course, not conclusive against it. A premillennialist might claim that these views developed in intertestamental Judaism from Old Testament rootage. Yet it does provide an explanation for the early premillennialism, which is consistent with rejecting it as the authentic eschatology of the Bible. All right, let's go on then to the withering of the early premillennialism. The growth of premillennialism did not continue. And there were two major influences which appeared to have brought about the complete demise of premillennialism. And they were the excesses of Montanism and the verdict of Augustine. First of all, the excesses of Montanism. The peculiar form of premillennialism held by the Montanists has already been discussed. Their extremes had a marked tendency to bring disrepute upon premillennialism in the early church and certainly contributed to its gradual demise. When several church councils in Asia Minor decreed against Montanism, this could not help but have a negative effect on their favorite doctrine of premillennialism. But even, and just as important, perhaps more important, was the verdict of Augustine. There was no greater theological authority for the Middle Ages, after the Bible, than Augustine of Hippo. When Augustine rejected premillennialism, the eschatological course of the next 1,000 years was set, and anti-premillennialism would be the position of the vast majority of Christian theologians. Augustine's key pronouncements against premillennialism occur in the City of God, Book 20, Chapters 6 through 10. In chapter 7, Augustine, having just described premillennialism, gives this assessment of it. And this opinion, that's to say premillennialism, would not be objectionable if it were believed that the joys of the saints in that Sabbath shall be spiritual and consequent on the presence of God. For I myself, too, notice what he says, once held this opinion. Augustine is saying that he was once a premillennialist. But as they assert that those who rise again shall enjoy the leisure of immoderate carnal banquets, furnished with an amount of meat and drink such as not only to shock the feeling of the temperate, but even to surpass the measure of credulity itself, such assertions can be believed only by the carnal. They who do believe them are called by the spiritual chiliast, which may be literally reproduced in Latin, which Augustine was writing in, by the name millenarian. It were a tedious process to refute these opinions point by point. We prefer to show how that passage of Scripture, he's referring to Revelation 20, should be understood. At this point, Augustine proceeds to give what is very clearly an amillennial interpretation of Revelation 20. Included toward the end of this exposition are clear indications that Augustine believes in a personal Antichrist who comes on the scene in the final little season before Christ's return after the 1,000 years are completed. Note chapters 13 and 19 of Book 20. These chapters of Augustine are fascinating in the light they shed on the withering of premillennialism in the early church. We see the process itself going on in the fact that Augustine once had held and then rejected premillennialism, so we see it withering in Augustine's own experience itself. We see something of the reason for Augustine's distaste for premillennialism. He sees it as encouraging a carnal hope for the future. It also seems clear that Augustine would find little practical objections to a premillennialism which had shed this kind of carnality. Although we must say as well that Augustine's subsequent exposition makes clear that he would still have serious exegetical objections to a premillennial interpretation of Revelation 20. The growth and withering or rise and fall of premillennialism in the early church may be diagrammed as follows. And you see the diagram there growing from some evidence for it in the early, late years of the year 100, growing to its high point, probably around the years 200 to 250, and then withering almost away, and then finally away under the influence of Augustine in the year 350 and afterwards. Now we must come to Roman numeral 4, because there's one other thing to be said about Augustine and his influence on future eschatological thinking. The doctrine of the medieval church, Roman numeral 4. These pronouncements of Augustine were of high authority throughout the period of the medieval church and even into the Reformation. Calvin himself probably held the same approximate view as Augustine. Yet the seemingly straightforward amillennialism of the city of God, in which the 1,000 years is identified as the whole period, except for the little season at the end of the age, between Christ's first and second advent, is not the whole story about the doctrine of eschatology which dominated the Augustinian church, the church from the time of Augustine till the Reformation. There is a different angle on this which must be considered, and I want to give you that different angle before we're done. Now, here's what we're saying. Augustine's interpretation of the city of God basically identifies the 1,000 years with the gospel age between the resurrection and the return of Christ. Except for a little season here at the end, which he identified as the period of the Antichrist. Okay. Now, that is the major view that you read in the City of God and other places. However, Augustine later on said some things that lead to a little different point of view. This is, of course, basically an amillennial structure. Okay? But I'm going to argue that he said some things that at least anticipated what we might call a postmillennial structure. And that's what I'm about to say. This angle or perspective, also found in the writings of Augustine, anticipates an eschatological perspective of a more postmillennial character. Augustine's relating of the church to the state in his controversy with the Donatists in North Africa forms the context of this perspective. During this controversy, which took place in the years after 410, if I remember right, during this controversy, as Leonard Verdine notes, it was Augustine who first presented a theological justification for the use of the state by the church to physically coerce the heretical or unconverted into becoming true Christians. Clearly, this implied an alteration in the church's anti-Nicene views of the relationship of the church to the state. Verdine describes this view as a Christian sacralism. He defines a sacral society as a society in which only one religion is permitted, as a union of church and state. Thus, political unity is thought in a sacral society to require religious unity. One state, one religion. This is confirmed by the less sensational presentation of Warfield, who notes that Augustine taught the concordance, as he puts it, of church and state, that they should work together. The justification of all this required certain fundamental changes in the earlier views of Augustine himself. Augustine's biographer, Peter Brown, comments, he had changed his mind on one point only. 10 years previously, he had thought that the ages before the coming of Christianity belonged to a more primitive stage of moral evolution, in quotes, and that in his own days, Christianity was purely spiritual religion. It had risen entirely above the physical sanctions and the enforced observances of that shadowy past, he means the theocratic kingdom in the Old Testament. Now Augustine, now that he's doing battle with the Donatists and trying to justify the state persecuting the Donatists, now Augustine was no longer so sure. Augustine now began to appeal to the Old Testament to justify physical sanctions against unbelievers. Verdine notes, it was easy for Augustine to slide back from Constantine to David, and from the church state known now as Christendom to the church state that was Israel. That backward slide is easy in the context of a flat theology. The phrase flat theology is Verdine's apt way of describing a theology which has missed the progression and upward movement of biblical theology. In other words, he's saying that in the Bible you have an upward movement from the Old Testament to the New Testament. And he is saying that the problem with Augustine is that he missed that upward movement and flattened out the difference between Old Testament and New Testament. That's what Verdine is saying by that. In other words, again using the language of Verdine, Augustine missed the distinction between early and late that characterizes the biblical revelation. There's an early period, there's a late period. And Augustine says, Verdine says Augustine missed that. Having missed the biblical distinction, however, Verdine notes that Augustine substitutes a false early and late of his own. This false early and late was made necessary by a certain objection raised against Augustine's theological justification of coercion. A complaint was raised by some who were having difficulty accepting the idea of compulsion in the things of the faith, that there was no example found in the writings of the evangelists and apostles of any petition presented in behalf of the church to kings of the earth against her enemies. In other words, they read the Bible and said, there's no evidence in the New Testament that the church ever asked the state to persecute her enemies or to deliver her from her enemies. This is precisely what Augustine and his large following were doing. In his letter to Vincentius, Augustine replied, who denies this? None such is to be found. But now notice what he says. But at that time the prophecy, be wise now therefore, O ye kings, be instructed, ye judges of the earth, serve the Lord with fear, was not yet fulfilled. What's he saying? He's saying that with the coming of the Christian emperor, Constantine, you had come to a different period in church history than that of the New Testament. Now, the New Testament period, recorded in the New Testament, that was early and not normative, and the period after Constantine was the late period, and in this late period, you basically worked by the principles of the Old Testament Davidic kingdom. Now, what's that say about the eschatology implied in it? Well, this citation from Augustine and many others brought forward by Verdine shows that Augustine felt that the difference between the persecuted church of the New Testament and the Constantinian church could be explained by the fulfillment of prophecies like the second psalm. Simply put, Augustine taught that there was a qualitative difference between the condition of the church in the New Testament period and the triumphant condition which the church had now attained in the Constantinian era prior to the second advent of Christ. This idea bears a striking resemblance to a certain school of eschatology, and Verdine does not miss this. However, before long, he and his followers were identifying the change that had put an end to cross-bearing with the millennium as pictured in the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation. And so now, this late period that divides church history, now this late period is the 1,000 years of Revelation 20. It is not then far-fetched to find the origin of post-millennialism, or at least the controlling and formative distinction of systematic postmillennialism in Augustine. And neither is it surprising that views of the relation of church and state, similar to his, have often characterized systematic postmillennialists. Indeed, strikingly similar views characterize the resurgent postmillennialism of the theonomic or Christian Reconstruction movement of our day. So what I'm saying is, that though you might not be able to call this postmillennialism in the later technical sense, essential to any view, any postmillennial view, is that there's a period in church history before the return of Christ and after the resurrection of Christ when the church passes from being persecuted to where the church becomes triumphant. That's essential to postmillennialism, and what you have here is that essential postmillennial distinction. And it's associated with what has often been associated with postmillennialism, and that's a view in which church and state are seen to be in union. And of course, that's a view that's held in some sense, perhaps in a more mild sense, but still in some sense, by theonomists or Christian Reconstructionists today, who also happen to be postmillennialists. That's the first lecture. I'm going to just push back the time just a little bit to give time for any questions you may have about that first lecture. Any questions? Gentlemen. Yes, Todd.
Was Augustine at any point really exegetically seeking to denounce the millennialism, or did he just basically present the millennial perspective as a substitute?
Only from the standpoint that he exegetes Revelation 20. He gives a very systematic and fairly lengthy exegesis of Revelation 20 from what we would call a non-millennial viewpoint. And that he says in the quotation, I'm not going to try to answer every one of their opinions. What I'm going to do is go to their key passage and give a different interpretation of it. So yeah, that's what he does. I'm not aware of any systematic attack on premillennialism. Other questions about anything that was said?
You give a discussion here of the apostolic fathers and their position on early premillennialism, and give us a couple of theirs. Are you suggesting that the other apostolic fathers do not address eschatology, or their eschatology is so simplified that it just speaks of eternal judgment, those kinds of things?
That's basically what I'm suggesting, yes. I'm not aware of any apostolic father who, for instance, attacks premillennialism. But those other writings are simply silent about the issue, primarily. They're not silent about eschatology as a whole. As I said, eternal punishment, the bodily resurrection, these are things that are referred to again and again and again. But in terms of premillennialism, you have the reference in Papias, the possible reference in Barnabas, and in the other six writings or so, there's really nothing definitive said.
But there's nothing in those writings which could be construed as pro-amillennial.
Now, that's something that I can't say for certain. I'm not aware of any distinct attack on premillennialism. I do recall, although I haven't cited any authorities for it, that there are statements that one would be inclined to interpret in an amillennial fashion, if one were an amillennialist, of course. And that gets us into the whole subject of, if someone speaks about a general judgment at Christ's second coming, does that permit us to assume that they're at least anti-premillennial? A premillennialist might not like to argue that way, but an amillennialist would. So I think we're left with the point that a lot of the writers are silent. Some of them say things that are inconsistent. I don't know of any definitive attack on premillennialism before the church councils of the 3rd century and that of Augustine. although there are men who probably make statements that show that they were premillennialists. And we know that men who were not premillennialists did exist from the witness of the premillennialists themselves.
Okay.
Another question? Yes, Bob.
Was there a distinctively, it'll sound like I'm trying to make a point here, but was there a distinctive post-millennial position developed, say, before Augustine?
I would say that I could be more clear there. I don't think that the entire, let's say, ethos of the writings of the early fathers or of the apostolic fathers are really very a very good environment in which to find postmillennialism. There was this aspect, there was this sense of an imminent return of Christ. There was this expectation of a personal antichrist. I don't know of any expectation of a great golden age on earth before Christ returns. I think that only begins to emerge, and even then not clearly, with Augustine. My own opinion after studying is that you could find some things that are sympathetic to premillennialism in the early church, some things that are sympathetic to amillennialism. You'd have to really stretch to get anything that's very sympathetic to postmillennialism. Okay? So it does sound like you're making a point, doesn't it?
It's kind of amillennialism by default.
Well, there's no statement of a postmillennial viewpoint that I'm aware of. And there are lots of things that you don't ordinarily associate with postmillennialism. Now, granted, there may be postmillennialists that believe in a personal antichrist and all those kind of things, but that's not something that you normally associate with it. Okay? And there is the view that it's a time of tribulation and persecution for the church, which only begins to disappear with Augustine and his interpretation of Constantine. So what you make of that, you know, it doesn't obviously speak in favor of postmillennialism, but I'm not sure that you could argue definitively against them on that basis. Of course, church history isn't the place where we find our definitive arguments anyway. Okay. All right, let's be dismissed, men. I guess there's some coffee and things back there. And yes, Todd wants to talk to you before you're dismissed.